and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi, and Daniel Bates.
On today's show, Kristen Radke, the designer, illustrator, and graphic novel creator, will be discussing her memoir, Imagine Wanting Only This, an ode to forgotten places and the temporary nature of life. And it has some great pictures, too.
We'll also hear about the history of Italo disco, the dance music genre that unites kitsch with hits, from Pietro Anton. He'll be discussing his documentary Italo Disco Legacy a little later on.
And we'll be getting into the minds of our favorite pampered pooches, with neuroscientist and dog behavior expert Gregory Burns. He'll be discussing his book, What It's Like to Be a Dog, at the end of the show.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Bill Luty will be on newshound duties for the news look ahead. And we'll spin some tunes too on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So, Danielle, the week has gone past pretty quickly once again. What have you been up to?
All work this week, but it's been good.
That's the energy of Midori House. I think you'll gradually get used to it. I feel like I'm always saying this. It's been a busy week here at our HQ in London.
Right.
And once again, that's the case. It's also interesting, obviously, I deal with food and drink, the menu and all that. And, you know, my colleague Josh Fennett has, for example, been really busy working on the Monocle Drinking and Dining Directory for this year, which is, by the way, out in the very end of this month on the newsstands by the beginning of next month. So that's a very special extra edition of Monocle Magazine, a special edition that focuses on food and drink, and that's where we will be releasing Monocle's Restaurant Awards this year, our top 50 list of best places to go and have a lovely dinner. Would you have some recommendations?
For dinner?
Yeah, where to go?
Where to go? There's so many places. This neighborhood, in fact, we've just done an episode of Food Neighborhoods where Kieran Matthew Banerjee walked us around Marylebone, and he's recommended a number of places to me. I have a few places on my list from Kieran's walk through the neighborhood, but Markus, I think I should be getting recommendations from you.
Oh, you know, I can give my recommendations from Helsinki, actually, because I was there with a couple of colleagues just some weeks ago. And I think Kallio District is really interesting at the moment if anyone goes there. There's lots happening over there. Great energy and new restaurants opening. If you eat Finnish food, I would definitely recommend a salmon soup. I would definitely recommend some blini, kind of more of a Russian thing, I guess, but very much enjoyed by my colleagues. Imagine pancakes with a bit of honey and sour cream and some roe maybe over there on the side and so forth. By the way, talking about that visit to Helsinki, I was there also with another person, and this other person is queuing to get into the studio now. It's Bill Luty who's joining us for the news look ahead.
Which way?
So welcome, Bill. What's happening this coming week or even today?
I've got one quite important political event and then two fun food-based events.
Sounds good. So what's the first one, the politically important one?
We're heading to Hungary, where there's a parliamentary election. All eyes should be, if they aren't, they should be on Hungary this weekend. Viktor Orban, the current prime minister, he looks like he's going to win with quite a big margin. There's a nationalist party called Jobbik, and they'll be coming second probably, and the socialists coming in third. Viktor Orban is a worry for lots of people, especially in Europe. If you think the Labour Party here has a bit of an anti-Semitism problem, there's nothing compared to Viktor Orban. He gave a speech back in February that wasn't very subtle with his hatred. He's saying they don't have a home, but they want to control the world and things like this.
It's very much about anti-immigration, his line. And actually, I was reading about something last week when it was, I think it was the New York Times that was writing about how he's been nominating his people to be in charge of important cultural institutions. So basically, he's using his power on very many levels to try to influence people's opinions when it comes to migration.
And it seems to be working. Lots of people there are clearly supporting him. He's also attacked George Soros, the businessman investor. And George Soros has said, obviously, he's being attacked, so he's going to come back. But he's saying this is extremely anti-Muslim, anti-Jew rhetoric, basically.
Seems to be a referendum on how far right he's moving the country,
yeah.
with his grip on power. Interesting to watch those results today as one of the countries in the region that seems to be treading along this more right-wing line.
And important for Europe. He said explicitly, I want to be out of Europe. So he may well use this, if he gets a really good result, to kind of drag Hungary back out of Europe, even though they've only just got in.
Exactly. Well, that's something we'll definitely be keeping an eye on tomorrow's morning edition of The Globalist and other shows as well. That's a bit gloomy as a starter for your news roundup. Do you have anything more optimistic and fun, Bill?
Nothing could be more fun
than
free ice cream. Ben & Jerry's ice cream, they've decided they're having free cone day. And globally, if you go into a Ben & Jerry's and you ask for some ice cream, it will be free. Anything you want. They've got dairy-free ice cream. They've got gluten-free cones. People are going to be going to Ben & Jerry's, but I think it's more of a public service announcement that people need to know that this is an offer that's available.
So what kind of ice cream do you like, Bill?
Well, it's controversial.
Is it?
But I really like mint choc chip. People think it tastes like weird toothpaste with bits of chocolate in, which is probably true. What about you?
I like chocolate with chips. Actually, I don't mind a bit of mint flavour either.
Yeah?
I think that's quite fine. Daniel, I've got a question for you. What's been your favourite, most memorable ice cream-related event in your life?
Ice cream-related? When I was a child and getting it all over my face and everywhere, right? I've got a young nephew now, and when I see photos of him with food everywhere, that's just like all my childhood photos.
When I was small, we used to go, and obviously here in the UK, you get the 99, which is that kind of soft serve ice cream. And my sister on the beach used to purposefully dip the ice cream into the sand and then lick the sand off because she liked the crunch.
She likes a little bit more of a textured ice cream then, still to this day, is that true?
She doesn't do that anymore. Okay. I think she's grown out of that now.
I remember reading from somewhere that Finnish people eat the most ice cream in the summer months in the world, which kind of, considering my habits over there, is quite
believable. Because it's so cold for the rest of the year.
Exactly.
I don't even think I said that's on Tuesday. Tuesday is free ice cream.
Let's try
day.
To remember that.
Moving on. Thursday through to Sunday, you have to be here in London, unfortunately. This isn't a global event. It's the London Coffee Festival.
Amazing.
Marcus, I know you've been to this.
I was there last year, actually. I was doing some reporting from there for the menu and also for the Sunday Weekend edition. What an event. Many coffee-related businesses over there showing what they have. You've got some free coffee. And it's actually an amazing place to go and kind of discover how much there is going on when it comes to roasting and good coffee. They also had some food that had coffee flavours. So definitely, I highly recommend that. I know you are more of a tea man, aren't you, Bill?
Well, I'm British, so of course I like my cups of tea in the morning. But I was looking at the latte art pictures on the website for this, and it's pretty incredible, some of the stuff they can do. There's like cats coming out of one cup going into a different cup, just made out of milk foam. It's insane. But I read also, if you fancy your hand a bit of latte art yourself, they're calling it latte art karaoke. It's more of like an open mic thing. If you think you've got what it takes, you can put your name down and you can go up on stage and you can test your skills against the professional latte artists.
Now, is this one of those events where there's also a bit of a competition where you have baristas from all over the world creating different
crazy
beverages?
Crazy patterns, crazy designs, yeah.
Okay. It is actually serious business. I remember the last year's winner. I believe he was from Japan, at least that's what I recall now. And actually what he created was absolutely amazing. I'd never seen anything like that, so...
It's intricate.
It's a great new hobby, maybe, for some of us.
I'll take it up.
Yeah.
We've got a little coffee machine here. I'm going to go and have a go now.
We can just wander down to the Monocle Cafe and take over from the staff there. They like us, right?
Guys.
Well, Bill is going to be the first one to do that, as me and Daniel, we have to stay in the studio because we are going to continue this program. Bill, thank you very much. And here on the Monocle Weekly, we'll be talking to author and illustrator Kristen Radke after this. Kristen Radke's new book, Imagine Wanting Only This, depicts the American illustrator, writer and designer's journey through young adulthood, reflecting on the temporary nature of life as she goes.
Through its beautiful illustrations, the book bridges not only Radke's personal story of coming to terms with the death of a loved one, but also looks at how change and renewal affects the places we live, too.
Throughout the narrative, there are visits to abandoned spaces such as Corregidor Island in the Philippines, decimated during the Second World War, an Icelandic town buried in volcanic ash, and even a ghost town in Colorado. Kristen joins us now to tell us more. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Kristen. So first of all, could you tell us about the moment when you decided to start working on this book?
I don't know if it was a moment as much as it was, I was just writing about these abandoned places or sort of aftermath and change and kind of hidden histories for a couple of years and did not realize at all that it was part of a book. I didn't even necessarily realize that the one topic had anything in common with one another. And it was, I just had a friend mention to me, oh, you're always writing about these same topics. This seems to me part of a larger project. And I slowly sort of came around to the idea that it could be a book.
The beginning of the book starts out with sort of the discovery of family and the world around as a child, and then the loss of your uncle sort of spurs this discovery to go further about self, but it's really about space, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And how did you get obsessed about abandoned places?
You know, I think it's a really common fascination. I don't think I'm particularly unique in that area. I think, you know, I mean, all you have to do is do a quick Google search and you'll see there's just thousands and thousands of people with blogs where they're going and photographing abandoned buildings. And I think it's not, you know, certainly it's gotten a pretty bad reputation. There's a lot of critics that call it ruin porn, which is something I write about in the book. And there is a way and certainly in which this kind of looking is very exploitative, this idea that we can go into a place in which we have no context or understanding for what happened and sort of gather things for our art. But I think, you know, partially we're sort of seeing modern cities decay in a way that we maybe haven't before. Like certainly like the Parthenon and the Acropolis and et cetera, are these huge tourist attractions. But suddenly now we're seeing, you know, declining infrastructure that means we're leaving places that look a lot like the places that we live, which I think is a lot scarier for us.
In your research for this, were you always aware of that concern of what you called ruin porn there while you were writing?
Not at first. I mean, when I started, really, the earliest pieces of this project started when I was very young, when I wasn't even quite 20. And I think I wasn't aware of most things at that age. But it was something I considered a lot as I moved forward in the book and something I tried to push up against a lot and call myself out on when I did it.
As we mentioned already, you have visited quite a few places, abandoned places such as Corregidor Island in the Philippines and an Icelandic town that's been buried in volcanic ash. Which places have been, say, the most important for you?
I don't know. I mean, I think probably Iceland was a really moving experience. The idea that the place you're talking about in Iceland is an island off the coast of Reykjavik in which a volcano erupted in the 70s and everyone left the island. It was very sparsely populated. Everyone left. The volcano covered almost the entire town. And then most of the people went back and rebuilt their homes on the other side of the island, which I just think is this really kind of extraordinary pilgrimage and idea.
So when you take into account all these places you visited and wanting to put together a book as a designer, editor, writer, do the illustrations come first or does the story come first?
In this case, it was the story. It's not how I always work now when I'm working on other projects. It's much more back and forth. And I think the strongest pieces of this book happened when I was composing drawings and writing at the same time. But initially, I imagined this project as straight prose. So the first drawings for this book were sort of like me translating prose into image.
I know you work designing other books as well. What, in your opinion, makes a good book cover?
Oh, good question. I don't know. You know, there's all of these arguments about, you know, you have to see a cover. You have to be able to read a title from across a bookshop or something like that. And then there's the whole book design has certainly changed since Amazon and we have to see things in little icons. For me, I like a cover that doesn't evoke necessarily the plot of a book, but more the mood of a book. I like a exterior that sort of clues me in as to what the experience is going to be like.
Could you also tell me more about the process when you were working on this book? What is the editing process like when it comes to illustrations?
I think it's pretty similar to editing just a prose novel. You know, we should put pressure on images in the same way that we put pressure on a sentence, and there's certainly a voice to image as well as to text. Like there's a visual language and a visual voice to images. So, you know, I did a lot of cutting of images. Some of the images just needed to be redrawn when they were weaker. And then sometimes I was maybe representing the wrong thing. So then I would just redraw that section. But the main thing I think in the editing process was realizing how to slow scenes down through image rather than through text.
Kristen, you've gone with a black and white motif here. And as you said, some of the things you needed to sort of redraw, some of them feel, the illustrations feel a little bit more finished, some of them a little bit more raw, like there's a double spread of sheep, sort of, that feels more like a sketch. Have you taken inspiration from elsewhere when you're doing this?
Yeah, certainly. I was pretty underread in comics as a kid. Like, yeah, I wasn't. I feel like most comics artists have these amazing stories of like the comic book shop in their town as they grew up, and they sort of had this history and this sort of education in comics. I came to comics really late in college, and it was through really like the famous graphic memoirs of the time, like Art Spiegelman's Mouse, Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis, Alison Bechdel's Fun Home. But realistically, I could never have written any, like, a single comic spread if it wasn't for Alison Bechdel. She was just, she just kind of like blew the doors wide open for me.
Do you think graphic novels are taken seriously enough next to traditional novels and writing?
I think it depends on who you ask. I think it's, everyone keeps talking about how it's changing, and maybe this is like the renaissance of the graphic novel, or this is the time. I think it's given much less space in media, and it's reviewed much less frequently. And I hope that that is beginning to change. But I think there is still a bias that it's less serious.
Discovering or exploring more this concept of space and empty space, are you working on anything else? Any other projects?
Yeah, I'm working on a collection of graphic essays about urban loneliness. It started as I was doing this series for The New Yorker where I was drawing people who were isolated in public settings. It's one of the really interesting parts, I think, about living in a city is just getting to observe people go about their days. And so I was starting to do big portraits like that, and that evolved into an essay collection about loneliness. And then I'm working on a graphic novel as well, which is in color this time.
But let's now return to the topic of your new book, Imagine Wanting Only This. I'm wondering, when you visited all these abandoned places, do you feel like you learned something from all that?
Not always. I think sometimes I would take this journey and I would save money up forever. I would apply to like 3 grants so that I could go do it. And then I often felt really sort of disappointed by the experience, I think, because I'd done so much research beforehand. And then, you know, some of the cities are still partially inhabited, but many of them, like Corregidor, is completely abandoned, and it's now just sort of a tourist attraction. And there is something that's really a letdown about that experience. It's like you've seen all the photos and they look exactly like they do in real life. Like there's nothing new to discover.
What kind of places have you seen recently, and do you feel the urge of going and discovering new places? And if so, what would they be?
I definitely don't feel the urge to continue to see ruins. I feel like that this really drove it out of there for me. But there were a lot of places that I visited for the book that ended up not making it into the book, like this island called Hashima Island, which is off the coast of Nagasaki, which was once the most densely populated plot of land on Earth and is now completely abandoned. And it was a sort of a mining island owned by Mitsubishi. And that was a really sort of startling and bizarre place to see.
Thank you for this, Kristen. And Imagine Wanting Only This is out now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
You are listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Marco Sippi, and Daniel Bage. Well, we'll be learning about the history of Italo disco in just a moment, so here is a vintage slice of that to prepare you. It's La Bionda with I Wanna Be Your Lover.
Make contact. Riding in a spaceship, 1984. Picking up a signal, never heard before.
From 1980, La Bionda there with I Wanna Be Your Lover. We'll be hearing more on Italo Disco in just a moment.
When the dance floor friendly sounds of US disco reached Europe in the late 1970s, something unforeseen happened. The drama became even more heightened, the concepts even more fantastical, and a distinctly Mediterranean flavor crept into the productions of what became known as Italo disco.
There are many debates about what constitutes an authentic Italo disco song, but you can loosely group them as being 80s pop with the fun turned up and smothered liberal helpings of synth and vocoders. Italo Disco Legacy is a new documentary by filmmaker Pietro Anton telling the genre's story. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco recently spoke to him about the film.
Basically, we can describe it as Italian synth pop. In its very essence, it's just Italian synth pop. But back then, They didn't have the notion of a new genre from the scratch. They just thought it was some sort of dance music or synth pop. The name Italo Disco was given to them by some German music guy, a manager from the label called Six, who just wanted to find a name to better label this music for marketing reasons. In fact, many of the people I interviewed, more or less without knowing it, Italo stars, everybody told me we didn't even know we were making Italo Disco. We just realized it with time.
Talking about realizing, I mean, when did you decide to do a documentary on the genre? Were you a fan when you were younger, or did you work in the industry? What was your connection with Italo Disco?
My main motivation was, of course, being a fan, but it started, I guess, when I was a child in the 80s. I heard this music a lot on the radio and on television. Maybe it was the more mainstream stuff, but still the basics. I got it from there, from the 80s. Later on, I rediscovered it, searching for old synth-pop music from the 80s from Italy, and started to know also the underground side of Italo Disco.
But another thing I would like to ask you, Pietro, I know it might be a hard question for you, but if there would be a song that would define the genre, and which artist is it?
Yeah, I'll give you some kind of personal answer because, of course, every Italo freak has pretty much his favorite track. To me, I guess, Walking in the Neon by Peter Richard, which was written actually by Rago and Farina, is probably my favorite Italo track. The typical Italo track, because it really sounds kind of gloomy in a way and upbeat, but still it has a certain atmosphere which pretty much has it all to me.
I do love, I have to say, one of my favorites, and it is mentioned in your film. It's by My Mind, Hypnotic Tango. And I have to say, it might sound cliche, but I've been hypnotized about the song. And something that happens to a lot of the Italo Disco songs, they're extremely catchy. I think one of the guests in the film say, it's the kind of song that you can sing along while you're shaving, for example.
Yeah, that's actually true. One of the secrets of Italo Disco long life was just its catchiness. The fact that actually you were able to memorize the melody and whistle along pretty much instantly. And that's something the dance music that followed sometimes miss. The fact of being recognizable in a way, enjoyable to the point you're actually willing to whistle it or sing its melody. That is, of course, one of the main strengths of Italo Disco.
Pietro, another thing, you know, even though, of course, it was a movement that started in Italy, but it became global. I mean, it was a huge hit in Scandinavia, even in Mexico, as mentioned in the film. So which countries actually were the highest number of Italo Disco lovers?
Talking about Europe, Germany and Scandinavia and Holland were probably the countries where Italo Disco actually succeeded the most. But, of course, we have to mention also Spain, France, Greece, and also the Eastern Europe was caught by this Italo fever. And when it went overseas to Mexico, for example, it became quite popular. I think the only countries where it didn't really succeed, at least at the beginning, were UK and US, maybe because the singing, the Italian accent of the singer was a bit too strong for a UK and US audience. And so they probably preferred the instrumental version where they didn't have to listen to this Italian accent, which maybe sounded a bit weird. Still, some people actually enjoy this kind of broken English. It became sort of cult even in the US and UK. In the US, it actually influenced lots of people of Detroit techno and house scene.
Well, I enjoyed the broken English. I have no problem with that. But and something that I would like to talk, I mean, at some point, there is a certain revival of Italo Disco nowadays. But for a while, it had kind of a bad fame, right? Because some people were accusing the artists of using like lip sync artists instead. So it became quite of kind of a fast-paced artist that just released like two singles, for example. What do you have to say about that? Because in my opinion, I don't know about you, Pietro, but even those, I don't know, considered bad artists, they still added fun to the genre in a way.
The best thing about Italo, it was kind of spontaneous. So the hits were just like blossomed spontaneously, especially in the beginning, in the early 80s, where basically they didn't really have a clue of what we're creating, actually. But that was the beautiful part of it, because hits and really small gems and songs, unforgettable songs, were born really out of the blue without really being planned that way. In the end of the 80s, when the genre was already selling a lot, the problem was that not that easy to keep that level of quality, spontaneity of the songs. And that's basically when the genre collapsed, because there were too many productions. Of course, the quality suffered.
Pietro, coming back to that thing that the genre is getting a little revival, what do you think of those new bands that are, of course, influenced by Italo Disco, like, for example, the Swedish band Italo Love?
Italove is actually a great band, because they assimilated the Italo patterns and mood. So basically they are, I think, one of the best expression maybe of this new wave of Italo disco, so to say. It doesn't surprise me that they are also popular in Mexico, and they play a lot, especially abroad. I must say I'm myself became an Italove fan, especially after seeing them live. And Martin Blix, the singer, actually was a guest star in Bergheim during our world premiere of a film and the party that followed. And he sang a couple of tracks on stage with Italo Connection.
Pietro, if our listeners all around the world, if they want to see a film, where and how can they buy it?
Well, actually, now the film is kind of touring after being shown in Germany and Holland, Norway, Finland last week, which was quite a success. There was a screening in London, and there will be another one in Manchester in May. The date will be announced on our Facebook page, Italo Disco Legacy. You can follow us. And as for the DVD, it was re-released now by Private Records, and it's now available again after the first copies were sold out. So both vinyl and DVDs are now available on Private Records.
That was Pietro Anton speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And Pietro's film, Italo Disco Legacy, is out now, along with the excellent soundtrack as well. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
It's a question we have all asked ourselves. What is it like to be a dog? Well, neuroscientist Dr. Gregory Burns from Emory University in Atlanta has been going further than most to try and find the answer.
He's been analyzing canine behavior and even scanning their minds to try and learn more. And his findings are in the new book, What It's Like to Be a Dog. He joins us from Atlanta now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Gregory. First off, perhaps, how does a neuroscientist get into studying dogs?
It really started as just a crazy idea several years ago when I just had this idea, can I train my dog to go in an MRI so I could see what she's thinking? And when I started, I didn't think it would go anywhere. I didn't know if it was going to work. And since then, it's exceeded my wildest expectations.
So how did you go on training your dog to go into an MRI scanner?
Well, I teamed up with a local dog trainer, and what we did was we simply broke the elements down from an MRI. The dog you hear in the background is not the one who actually was trained. But the basic idea is we built a simulator of an MRI in my basement. And so it was a giant tube. And we constructed a mock-up of what we call the head coil, which is what the dogs have to put their head into. And really just using positive reinforcement, a lot of treats and a lot of praise, we taught the first dog, whose name is Callie, to put her head in a little chin rest inside this simulator. And then we started adding in the recordings, audio recordings of the actual scanner sounds to get her used to the sound that it makes.
So how much have you learned so far? How much can you tell us? For example, dog owners often think their pets understand them and that a dog and an owner have a meaningful connection. Do you agree with that now?
Well, I think the thing that is most obvious to me after studying so many dogs is how different the dogs are from each other. They're as different from each other as people are from each other. So any experiment that we do, we see a range of responses. So, for example, we did one experiment where we compared the dog's reward response in the part of their brain associated with reward and how it responded to the expectation of food versus the expectation of a social reward like simply praise or, you know, saying good girl or good boy. And what we found was most of the dogs had equal responses to both of them, indicating that they like and are probably motivated by both equally. And then we have a few outliers at either end of the spectrum where we have a few dogs who are really motivated or their brains seem to be really motivated by the social reward, and then a few who are really all about the food. So it really comes down to the individual dog and perhaps also the human itself and that relationship that they form. But the interesting thing about it is that there are signatures in dogs' brains that seem to go along not only with their personality and temperament, but perhaps also their predilection for certain types of roles in our environment, whether it's a working role or more of a pet or therapy role.
I'd like to return to the previous topic we discussed, what exactly dogs are thinking. How much can you tell us about what dogs are thinking, you know, during the day when they're not necessarily spending time with their owners?
That's a much more difficult question because all the experiments that we do involve them generally interacting with humans. And we're now getting to the point where we can identify those.
What do you hope to find at the end of this?
Well, I think part of it is just basic knowledge. It's understanding the evolution of the nervous system and brains in general. So as humans, it will tell us something about, you know, what is it that makes humans different from other species. So it's not the case that our brains are identical, obviously, because we have different cognitive skills. But what's interesting around in neuroscience is that there's very little data on other species other than humans and rats and mice. And so the goal is to fill in the evolutionary tree to understand how we got where we are, at least in humans, and then what is it about other animals that make them particularly well suited for the environments that they live in, which of course are disappearing rapidly. In many cases, they have core emotions very similar to ours. They certainly experience things like pleasure, and they have expectations, and they have wants and needs, some of which are very much like ours. So, you know, it makes you appreciate how similar we are and that they are sentient beings.
And then the important questions. Gregory, do dogs like people or do they like food better?
I think it's very clear from our experiments on food versus praise that the majority of dogs that live with us in our homes have at least equal likes for both, and some have more for the humans. Obviously, no animal is going to starve just for the love of their human, but I think it's the case that the dogs that we live with have at least equal love for both us and the food that we give them.
And are those dogs being honest? Are they being nice to their owners because they know they will get food that way, or do they actually like their owners?
No, I don't think that it's that disingenuous. I think based on the brain responses, which I don't think lie, I don't think the dogs can actually lie, it seems genuinely there.
Gregory, animals, or dogs for that sense, if we can stick with dogs, different types of dogs respond to different types of training, different types of signals. Have you learned anything about how we as humans could improve our communication and thus better improve our relationship with the animals we love so much?
Yeah, we're actually working on a series of comparing how dogs learn based on the modality that we communicate with. So, for example, we're actually studying how well do they learn based on the sense of smell versus visual stimuli versus auditory or actual just language, human words. And it seems very clear from our data that human words are the least efficient in the dog's brain, that they learn much better with visual signals as well as olfactory or odors. Now, that says a lot about training dogs. You know, we're not going to necessarily use odors to train them, but it may be that they respond much better to hand signals and visual signals than the words that we attach to them, even though we tend to do both. So what that means for communicating with dogs, if we insist on using human language, dogs can learn something from it, but I think we have to be realistic in our expectations, and probably simplicity is the best. You know, maybe a name and one or two words at most, a verb and a noun, perhaps.
Thank you, Greg. And your book, What's It Like to Be a Dog, is in bookstores now. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly. Well, that was a good show. Thank you very much for that, Danielle. I'm wondering, do you have a pet dog? Do you deal with dogs? Have you ever been wondering what they're thinking about?
Often, yes. I had a black lab through my teen years and into my 20s. Sadly, my parents had it. It died recently. Beautiful animal. And the dog, I felt, had a deep connection to me personally because I raised it. I always wondered, is it just loving me with those big brown eyes because I am the master of the food? Who knows?
That's all for edition 457 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our researcher was Amber Roberts. Also, our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Markus Hippi.
And from me, Daniel Bage. Goodbye.